Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit mofad.org.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
It was something familiar. Like the sound of the sea. I forgot I remembered. Like some lost part of me. It was only a flicker. It was barely a trace. Only there for and then gone from your face. Like the way we're tied, still tethered to the shore. The thought just pulled me back to before. But I know we're alone, and my mind clings to memory like a heart to a home. Reflections at sundown can make me so sad, for there's no way keeping the day we've just had.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I am sitting in the basement of Clove Club, which is actually larger than your old office used to be. So things have been obviously going incredibly well. Windows?
We upgraded.
Yeah, super upgraded.
There comes a point.
Sitting with Daniel and Johnny. Good to see you guys again, as always.
Nice to see you, too.
Yeah, my first stop always when I come to town. So for the, like, handful of the uninitiated, give us the backstory. You have 2 minutes.
Go. 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, go.
Go.
So the Clove Club opened in 2013 in Shoreditch Town Hall. Before that, we did some supper club pop-up stuff, and then we did a residency with a pub. which was kind of a precursor to doing all this stuff. But now we are in our own four walls, Shoreditch Town Hall, open 2013. We quickly established it as hopefully one of London's kind of new ambitious restaurants. We have received a number of different awards. We got number two in the National Restaurant Awards. We broke into the 50 best, number 87. Then last year we came 55 in that. And fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Well, this is going to air on a later date, but this weekend you're going to New York.
Yep. We are.
New suits, new haircuts.
Yeah.
Okay. Last week. Yeah, it's fine.
You need to get a week before,
Yeah. I got a haircut for Darren's wedding like a month before. I don't have that much hair, so it's gotta grow back. And so, fingers crossed. Well, I guess by the time we'll know whether or not where you guys land.
Yeah. Well, the 51 to 100 has been published.
Yes.
Oh.
And we're not listed in it.
Okay.
So it's either very good,
or that's fucking terrible.
Yeah. Or a step back from last year, shall we say?
So one of the things, and that was excellent. That was 2 minutes. You did such a good job.
I missed
that
in the Michelin star, so we got one of those.
Yeah. Amazing how, like,
to mention Isaac.
Well, I mean, that's up to you if you want to mention. Yeah, of course, Isaac, who's obviously up in the kitchen.
Yeah.
One of the things, I mean, it's funny because, like, when those things happened, they were such big milestones, but now you've told the story so many times, they are just kind of, like, they become mile markers along the way of that, like, the global recognition of the success and the hard work you've done. And one of the things, having known you, the three of you, for so long, that I keep coming back to when I was doing research with this, was, like, evolution.
Yeah.
And I think, like, that's a really interesting concept because where you started to go and where you are now. And I'd be kind of curious, like, what themes do you see have, like, carried through that, like, the ethos from the beginning that still kind of remain if you're coming to eat in Clove Club in 2016?
I think the main thing for me is the format, in a way, is kind of still the same as it always was. Like, right from the start, it was, you know, you paid in advance for, like, 4 courses, and you got some snacky things at the start, and then it was 4 courses, and then we finished off with, a couple of sweet things and a digestif. And regardless of what's happened, it's like, you know, within that kind of template, that's one thing that I'm often struck by, is that we've been doing the same thing regardless of the environment or the price point. It still comes back to that, trying to create that most amazing meal, but still with kind of, those parameters haven't really changed, you know? I don't know how you feel about it.
Well, it's been about, I suppose, I agree with that, definitely. It's about embellishing and evolving on those very same ideas, isn't it?
Yeah.
And not only on the restaurant floor and in terms of, you know, the direct guest experience in the restaurant, whether it's a new way of cooking that Isaac comes up with, or it's a new way of serving cocktails, or whatever it is, but also our kind of, the way we've embraced technology to help us develop and improve the guest experience as well, you know.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And I also want to come back to Isaac and his cooking as well, but it's been a little bit over a year since you adopted Talk. And I think you were the first London restaurant to really, if not in the UK, to do that. The response was interesting. It was, like, very similar to how, like, they rolled it out in the States, but, like, how has it been adopting that, and, like, what other technology have you used to help with the guest experience, both for you guys and for the guests themselves?
Talk's been a totally positive experience, I'd say. I think there was initially a little bit of kickback.
Yeah.
It's a new thing for many people to have to pay in advance to come to a restaurant. But I think we had so much goodwill from the guests who'd been here, and they kind of, when you explain the reasons behind it, in terms of, you know, protecting ourselves as a business from no-shows and short-seated tables, then guests get on board with it and they understand it, and it's people embrace it now. People actually like the process of going through the website and kind of having this new experience of selecting how many people they're going to come with and the time they come. So.
Yeah, it's funny actually. I purchased tickets for Mitch's dinner at Lyle's. Because they use Talk for their guest series dinner, and I was just struck by how really how easy and simple it is. You don't have to sit on the phone, get someone to take your credit card details. There's none of this kind of, you just go on and, you know, and it's just done. And actually it's, you know, some of the things that I reiterate to guests or journalists are, you know, kind of nice to have that from the customer perspective, in that, you know, the credit card details that you give are stored, even just something a little like, it's stored in a vault, it's on the internet, it's not like just written in to someone's book or like on an open table in a guest note or whatever. It's and it's really, really quick and easy to use. And I think interestingly, speaking to them recently about in conversation about how different ways of how we can use it for events or other or in other ways, they basically they said, like, they, from Tok's perspective, it's the game's changed now, like, the, you know, it's out, people have experienced it, you know, right across Europe, which I think was a little bit behind because obviously it came out in the US first. People are much more kind of aware of it and not resistant to it. It's not this kind of indignant shock that they have to pay for a meal before they've had it.
And like you said, Lyle's uses it, but has it spread to more in the year? Has it spread to more restaurants? Or is it still, because in the States it's kind of adopted by a certain level of restaurant?
Yeah,
likewise. Hey, yeah, but Tok or equivalent systems are versatile in terms of how you can use them.
Yeah,
and simply on the point of discouraging diners from not showing up for their reservations, it can be used in a multitude of ways. You know, even just paying a small deposit per diner just to dissuade them. I think it's interesting how technology is. In the restaurant industry, it feels like there's about to be great change. If you look at Tok and people paying in advance, you look at Danny Meyer and Dave Chang in America, and they're abolishing tipping, etc.
Which we're kind of just catching up to European systems in that way, fair wages and all that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a minefield. I think that actually it's used very fairly over here, but the whole idea of it is that it's kind of a grey area which is managed in a certain way. There's certain hoops that you have to jump through to allow you to, which, you know, over here it's called trunk. But it can be as easily abused as it can used in
for fair wages.
Yeah, okay. When it's used properly, it's an incredibly fair way to pay your staff. Mm. But when it's not, then it's, you know, you can have a pretense of paying everybody fairly and using this money that essentially you're asking your guests to give for staff, and that's where they're presuming it's going. And then sometimes it just doesn't make it there, which is a bit weird in that sense. But then again, you know, so in the UK, when you have that, if it's used well and fair, then there's less cash tips given, which means or none, which means that everyone pays tax on it, which goes towards the National Health Service. The kitchen receives as much as it if it's divvied up fairly enough, as well as the waiters. So there's not this, you know, disparity and complete contradiction of the people sometimes that work the hardest in the kitchen that are doing the most hours receive the least amount of money.
Right.
And the people that get the most amount of money do less hours. They're not necessarily the least skilled, but in some cases they are. And they're also not paying any tax on any of this. And in
right.
the UK, if it's done fairly, it is very good. It's very efficient and it's very fair.
Yeah. I mean, fairness, I think, is like under this agreement, which is why I like talk and those are things. It's fair to the restaurant. There's no other really services in the world that you would actually like pay after or not, or like it just doesn't make sense. So you mentioned
it's just re-educating people, isn't it?
Yeah, and you mentioned other technology to help besides talk. What else have you done with it in the dining room?
Technology in the dining room. We've got a fancy new lighting system where you press one button and all the lights change to different levels. I can't really think of an example in the dining room.
No, I think it's something that I would say we have more of a progressive approach to things that we can use to improve the business. Technology in terms of like the guest-facing element, less so. But just even little things like the way in which you use an iPad, for the information, for the guest notes and stuff, and like just a way of distributing information to kind of, you know, improve service. That's, you know, there's a whole heap of things that you can do, which, you know, aren't rocket science, but, you know, take time to kind of embed into the culture and people's approach to kind of, you know, improving guest experience, I suppose.
And on top of the guest experience, the food, and you said you've embraced technology in the kitchen as well. So, like, how is Isaac, now that you've grown bigger and you've kind of grown out of your former spaces, like, how does that come into play with, like, the dishes that you're putting out these days?
Isaac's never kind of really chased after the latest bits of equipment and the latest cooking techniques, although he observes them and he embraces them where he feels necessary.
Which is the best approach. Like, early adopters are kind of like, that's all gimmicky, but a slow fold-in is like the most valued, especially, or, you know, if you're not first, then be choosy.
Yeah,
so kind of, you know, Isaac will buy equipment as and when he feels he needs it. You know, we've had a PacoJet since day one, for example, but we've never had a sous vide machine. We've just got a blast chiller because it, you know, makes sense because we've only got a small kitchen. So I think he kind of, Isaac's very interested in craft and the process. You know, he massively influenced by Japanese food and he loves his Japanese knives, etc. But He doesn't chase after the latest technology in terms of it really influencing what goes on the plate. It's all about the quality of the ingredient and the idea and the concept behind it.
And then, like, as you have continued to evolve, have you had more time to be experimental or push the technique in the kitchen? I mean, the raw scallop dish that you guys brought out last night was incredibly simple on the plate, but you could just tell that was, like, so much time and so much experimentation. So many of the, like, larger restaurants will just have like experimental kitchens. Have you found more time and freedom to be able to do that type of experimentation?
I think it's always a stress, I know, for Isaac to try and, with such little space, you know, to try and find that time to get on a stove or get some space in the oven. So times I don't think is an issue has changed. I think there's little things now. For us, it's always a challenge with the space. That's the main thing. And in a lot of ways, that is what defines the food here. Like, you'll have a couple of raw fish dishes to start off with because there's no space to have a cooked fish dish, then a cooked meat dish, then a cooked fish dish because there's just one guy on one six burner. And so from that perspective, it's finding new ways to be creative within those kind of constraints. But again, like, just a little thing, like you mentioned on Schwanky New Office, well, that's made way, us leaving it has made way to put a cold room in downstairs so we can age the meat. So now we have more control. So there's, while it's not a technological advance, it's more space to try different things in terms of how long we age the meat and which meats we age. Similarly, just having little things like a vac pack machine now, we can kind of play around with that. The guys in the bar have been playing around with that, so you can have just saves on space. We can play around with those sort of things, and I think that's, the tools haven't particularly changed massively, but it's finding new and interesting ways within the constraints we've got to kind of, for things to evolve. And, you know, something like that raw fish dish, I think, is a classic example. You know, there's nothing crazy gone into that you couldn't do, you know, in a domestic kitchen if you had enough time and the technique and the knowledge. So I think that's always going to be the challenge at Clove Club, unless we move house, which is, you know.
All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and then we'll be back to talk about London food scene and the next upcoming project.
I wanna find
So one of the things that's like really changed in the last, you know, kind of 10 years is the London dining scene. And I think that maybe 10 years ago, it would not have been receptive to what you're doing. How do you feel what you've done has kind of helped to push the current dining scene in London? And, you know, who else is inspiring you to kind of push things forward?
By virtue of the fact that we were able to start a restaurant from our front room of our flat, you know, 5 years ago, and we've gone through the different stages of being in a flat, doing pop-ups around London, running a six-month restaurant above a pub, and then finally signing a lease and opening a restaurant here. You know, just going through that process, and that process being embraced by keen food lovers around London. Just going through, just the fact that that's able to happen is kind of, it really shows what you're able to do, especially in a city like London that embraces mm-hmm. food so much.
And do you think what do you think that you were able, that you had to, what rules did you have to still comply by that were like the tried and true rules, and what things did you like maybe like before you didn't like, you didn't have to follow them? Like the white tablecloths, all that type of stuff, or like what could allow you to kind of grow in like the current landscape?
I think we wanted to do something which was personal to us, and while we didn't want to try and choose things to differentiate ourselves just for the sake of it, you know, the Clothes Club, I always very much fondly look back on in its first incarnation is that it was designed by the three of us about what would the restaurant look like that we want to go to, you know. And we kept on coming back to it. What do we like about the restaurants? What do we like about eating out? What don't we like? And that, I suppose, were the key elements. And then there were other things like, you know, we just couldn't afford linen, so we didn't do it. And, you know, while at the same time we weren't, you know, naive enough to think that it wasn't a statement, it was also just, you know, I worked at St. John, you know, you don't get bread plates there, you just get bread put down and you just crack it open on the table and get stuck in. And I think that kind of rustic element of our kind of, from Johnny and I anyway, in terms of our kind of training and where we come from, I think has always been a really nice counterpoint to Isaac's experience in fine dining. And I think, you know, when we started doing, you know, over everything that we've done, it's kind of, in the first instance, it came around at a time where, you know, there was a lot of really classic kind of, you know, some quite boring restaurants in London. And I think people really responded to what we were doing because it felt new and fresh and exciting. And I think it came around at a time when you had to maybe go to a restaurant where you didn't feel comfortable to eat really great food. And here something came along where you could eat that really amazing food, and, you know, there were two northern jokers who just kind of made you feel comfortable. And I think that was a big part of it, I think, for people.
And I mean, and looking to the future, obviously, you know, how do you keep pushing this, or where does the evolution come from, both the food side and the service side as well, or the approach, you know, after this weekend and everything, and, you know, knock on wood, the place is secured, like, where do you think that it goes, or where does, you know, how to keep being ahead of what you think the customers want or anticipating their needs?
Oh my God. I think we work closely, the three of us, which I think is a really important point. You know, Daniel and I aren't necessarily involved in the food on a day-to-day basis in terms of cooking and preparing it, but then neither is Isaac actually, you know, manipulating the reservation system, well, he is partly. But the fact is we're constantly all talking about the business and how to improve it, about the food, about the wine. You know, we're constantly taking inspiration from places we go to, restaurants we eat at, people we meet. And, you know, we care about progression and development. We're not chasing the latest thing.
Mm.
We're just really passionate about constantly trying to improve the guest experience wherever possible. And it kind of, you know, sometimes 2 months will go past and not much happens, and then suddenly have a flurry, and, you know, you'll have three intense months where, you know, we look at the tea and coffee service and we change it all. We look at how we're going to start serving DJ Steves. We look at the petit fours. We look at how we're going to present the bill to the guest so that you can embellish their experience in some way.
That's really interesting, because I think when people kind of look from outside looking in, it like looks not fully formed, or it's like a little bit of thing. So, I mean, when you're looking at like take presenting, I would love to know, how did you improve on presenting the check to the guest?
Well, we've never have.
Oh, okay.
So we discussed at length, but never just got around to doing. Isaac at points got really into origami and trying to make these things, which didn't actually get implemented. But yeah, I think it's just, you know, it's kind of like the Golden Gate Bridge, the whole process. You know, as soon as you've got to one point where you're happy with something, you know, the last thing that you changed, or the first thing you changed within that process is now out of date, and you've got to look at that again. You know, coffee and tea honestly hasn't changed since we opened, and we've never been happy with it. And Isaac and our head barman Rob have put a ton of effort into that, and we've all been part of that process, but, you know, we're really, really near changing that over, and when it does, it's going to be really, really amazing. We're going to have some amazing teas. We've saw some really amazing teas and coffees, and it's going to be really, really, really great.
I mean, a lot of the great restaurants do say that, like, the coffee service is, like, such a missed opportunity to really just, like, the final impression, just to really wow the guests.
Yeah, completely. I think people, more and more people have been exposed to different types of coffees now, and quite often having something which is slightly lighter in caffeine, you know, and kind of showcases lighter fruitier flavours, for example, might be a nicer option rather than having a heavy double espresso at the end of the meal, you know, just for example. I think, just going back to kind of the involvement of this restaurant, restaurants are living and breathing spaces, you know, especially when you observe seasonality, for example. And also, you've got to remember the staff that come through the door. So each year, you have the same kind of ingredients. You know, you have peas and asparagus and morels, say, May time each year, okay? But you might have a different set of chefs in the kitchen, or a different bartender, or a different sommelier working within your team. And all these people have different ideas about those ingredients or about those circumstances. And by virtue of that, it's evolving, it's changing, you know. And, you know, we're here every day. We need to feel like we're going somewhere. We're on a journey. It can't be the same from year to year.
Speaking of changes, we can talk about it. Mm. You have a new space.
Yeah.
So what can you share?
We can't really tell you the name because we are waiting for waiting for trademarks to get back to us to let us know if we can actually use it.
And after having had to change the name already.
After having one that we were really happy with.
Post-branding.
And a well-known London operator, unfortunately, just randomly choosing the same syllables. I'll let you go. You go.
We are going to be opening a new restaurant, which is about 10 minutes away from the Clove Club, that will serve modern Italian food with great seasonal British produce.
British produce seen through an Italian lens.
Fantastic. And there'll be no crossover. None of the dishes that were experimented here will come over there. It's a totally brand new.
I mean,
it's still Isaac.
You know, exactly the craft involved. We make our own salumi, salami here. We may do some of that at the Clove Club. At the new restaurant, the name I can't mention. there will definitely be some crossover, but they're going to be a new set of dishes, basically. Term which we are using is Britalian to describe the kind of the food, the wine, the concept a little bit. And you won't see Britalian written anywhere in the restaurant. It's just a kind of nice, cheeky, fun way of summing up what this restaurant what we hope it to be.
And one of the things that you mentioned was, like, you couldn't afford linens,
yeah.
so that's why linens weren't here. And one of the great things about creativity is that a lot of it comes from constraint.
Yeah.
So, like, how are you, you know, given that, like, you are so established now and a global level, what type of way will you be, you know, kind of trying to enforce, like, not force creativity, but
yeah.
creative thinking when you have a lot more freedom, I'm guessing, backing, et cetera, into the project?
Well, you know, we're not backed by the Middle East. We're taking a massive loan from the bank to make it happen. So in that sense, we're still going to approach our Northern and Scottish frugal spending habits to make it happen. So in that sense, it's still, we still have similar constraints. I think what we're most looking forward to, and probably jealous of this restaurant in comparison to the Clove Club, is hopefully we're going to get it right first time round. There were so many things we just knew we had to buy that were, like, cheap, which we knew we were going to have to replace, but we just couldn't afford to do it because we were just getting really, really close to opening a restaurant with vapor in the bank, which is, you know, the one thing that you shouldn't do. So, yeah, I think from all of our perspective, it's going to be about 124 covers, which is... A Clove Club as a space is quite big. It's just it's an awkward space because of the two rooms. But again, it's probably a third bigger than Clove Club with less awkwardness too, I suppose. So it's going to be big. And from that sense, it's going to be a completely different business model, which we're really looking forward to kind of attacking, really.
Just yeah, 100%.
Creating. And it'd be interesting, you know, we're constantly labelled with the restaurant where you have to buy the set menu before you get through the door, and it's just, it'll be really, really nice for us, I think, to have, to not be labelled the hipster restaurant because we're in Shoreditch, to not be, you know, to have these kind of opinions, opposing opinions of what we're doing because of the format we've chosen. And it'll be, yes, it's going to be really great. It's hopefully going to be a really kind of family orientated space and business, and feel really inclusive by virtue of a la carte. The price point would be lower, definitely from the point of pre-entry. So that I think we're really looking forward to. It's going to be 7 days, just all the things that you love about kind of, you know, Italian trattorias is kind of going to be our version of that a little bit further into town.
The venue layout's going to be in, the only reason I mention that is just because there's different areas of the restaurant we'll be exploring, different kind of concepts and ideas, I suppose. There's going to be a front bar area which will be really light and airy and vibrant, and, you know, open for breakfast, lunch and dinner, kind of small sharing plates kind of concept with, you know, a homemade martini, homemade vermouth blend for drinks, for example. And then the main dining room, where Isaac's going to be making homemade pasta with the team, which is interesting. So interesting for the kitchen to kind of explore new techniques and crafts like pasta making. I think it's something that Isaac has kind of always wanted to do, but never been able to really give it the attention that it deserves at Clove Club.
Yeah.
Whereas here, with the new style, you know, new type of cuisine, new space, it's...
Kitchen's going to be headed up by Robert Chambers, who Isaac worked with back at the Ledbury. Very talented chef, half Italian, worked at La Canda Locatelli. Isaac's definitely going to help oversee, but he's going to remain at Clove Club.
And you guys get to tell a new origin story now as well, which is no more pop-ups and more of something. So thanks for making time.
Not at all.
Where can people find information on Clove Club and the yet-to-be-determined name of the new space?
Oh, I would say you'll have to just, we'll have probably, hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll have a new Clove Club website, which is in development then. So we'll go to thecloveclub.com, and if there's no information on the Clove Club website, if our website hasn't been redesigned by then please email hello@thecloveclub.com and say, where is your new restaurant in capital letters as the title, and we'll let you know.
Perfect. Well, thanks for making time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be back with the second part of Snacky Tunes.
Ooh, There are over 50,000 Chinese-American restaurants in the U.S. That's more than three times the number of McDonald's. How did Chinese-American food become so popular? And what's the story behind their unique menu of dishes like egg rolls and General's Chicken? Brooklyn's Museum of Food and Drink is going to explain it all with our next exhibition, Chow, the Making of Chinese-American Cuisine, featuring tastings, beautiful artifacts, and live demos of a fortune cookie machine. Visit chow.mofad.org to learn more, get advanced tickets, and help us make this exhibition a reality. Again, that's the Museum of Food and Drink at C-H-O-W, chow.mofad.org.
Welcome back. We have Josie and Clark and Ben Walker here in the studio. First U.S. radio show?
Yeah,
I think so.
Welcome.
Awesome.
Thanks for joining today.
Cool.
How was Philly last night?
Good. It's a nice town.
Yeah. Where did you play?
At the Tin Angel.
Oh, okay. Oh, great venue.
Yeah.
How was your first U.S. tour going?
Good. Obviously, it's like super exciting for us because not so many like British artists get to come out. Certainly not so early on in the kind of U.S. venture.
Yeah. I mean, you're so established in your home country. Mm. How is like the mind shift of, you know, you won a big award last year from BBC and all that stuff, but how is it like kind of coming to a new country and I don't want to say starting over, but
Well, I mean, we're not as big as the Beatles in the UK, but we certainly like don't have trouble like filling rooms and like people generally know who we are. So it's kind of a bit weird. Like we remember being this new just about in the UK, so it's there, remembering how to do it.
Finishing some of the concerts, some of the shows, and sort of going, oh, it's like that one time when we played to. It's good. You're right. It is a mind shift.
Yeah.
But it's one you do and you just deal with it.
It's kind of nice to have the opportunity to slightly reinvent yourself as well.
I guess a lot of people if I had the chance to do it again.
Born again.
Mm. Yeah. So what are you doing differently, or what are you reinventing in the States?
I think we're trying to be cooler. I don't know how well that's going.
We've got a rap section in one of the songs now.
Yeah, just putting some grime, dubstep on stuff. No, not really.
How do you be cooler?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
So let's, for the people who don't know you, how did you two meet and how did you start working together?
Ben was in an indie band, like an indie rock band.
Name check?
Lights.
They were called Lights. And then we had to change it because it's a Canadian singer called Lights.
He was in that, and a sound engineer friend of mine was mixing some tracks for them, and he heard Ben play an acoustic guitar, and he was like, "What are you doing in this band? get an acoustic project." And he said, "Oh, I don't know any singers." And I was playing bad guitar for myself and was looking for a guitarist, and so he kind of set us up. And that was seven and a bit years ago.
Yeah.
And was it instantaneous? Or how was the process of beginning to work together?
I think musically, it just kind of worked right from the beginning. We have some musical instincts that are exactly the same, but also if you look at our record collections, they're also completely different, so we kind of, it's enough of the same stuff and different stuff to keep it interesting.
Who's in their respective collections? What's in your record collection?
I'm all kind of 70s folk revival singers, jazz,
I tend to go from everything from Aphex Twin and Allsecker all the way to Frank Zappa, and
which is how you were able to call it Nelly.
Yeah.
Before that started.
Yeah.
So that's how he knows.
He knows just from the bass lines.
Yeah, just three beats. I could just do it in three beats. I could give you every 90s rap song ever written. As you kind of combined your backgrounds and you moved away from your indie projects, what was the process of writing together, and how did you begin to develop your sound together?
I guess I had a small collection of songs when we started working together, and Ben just kind of put some extra chords in them for me and made them sound better and more interesting.
That's how I get 33%.
I just had three, and he's kind of pushed it to four or five.
Yeah.
And then he had some sort of guitar
couple of instrumental things
that like he didn't have a place for, and I kind of worked on those and put like melody and lyrics on them, and we made songs out of those. So we kind of have like two ways of writing. Mm. We have, I bring him something and he makes it better, and the stuff where he's got something that he doesn't know what to do with and I make it into a song.
And has that still remained seven plus years later, now that you are fully entwined as a duo?
Yeah, most recently we started writing in the same room, haven't we? We never used to do that. It's like I used to bring my stuff, and then we would like work on some stuff together, and then I would go away and he'd have put an entire chamber orchestra on a song for me. But we've started doing some stuff where we kind of just
hash sort of bouncing ideas back and forth, which leads to completely different results, really. I mean, it's still us, but I think it's just a different way of working, which...
Well, we're trying, like, consciously to be more fluid in, like, lots of different ways in performance. Like, we used to kind of do the classical model of, like, there's a definitive, like, type of, like, version of this song, and we just play that. And we're trying to kind of push the boundaries of that and be a little bit more improvisatory. And we've kind of done the same with the writing.
I mean, it makes it interesting for live performance as well, because you sort of... When you're doing a tour, you do end up playing, you sort of settle into a pattern and play the similar sort of thing or the same thing each night after night after night. And actually, if you've got that fluidity there, you can kind of say, well, actually, we'll try it, but at this point, we're going to try to change things up.
It's sort of like trying to play them slightly differently so that our minds don't wander off and think about sandwiches. Because that happens.
What type of sandwich do you think about?
I'm thinking about bagels mostly, because okay. New York. What was it you said you were thinking about?
Oh, laundry.
Yeah, Ben started thinking about his laundry.
But how do you balance that, obviously, in London, where they know your music quite well, versus, you know, your first U.S. tour when you're kind of introducing yourselves, where, like, it might be a variation for you, but maybe not, like...
I think that here people don't notice. I think that's the thing. But you're kind of like, it gives, because we've got completely new audiences, it gives those songs a little bit of a freshness for us anyway, because people are hearing them for the first time, rather than in the UK sometimes you feel like you're playing people the same kind of,
I mean, it's the thing within the UK, because it is comparatively such a small country, you do find a lot of people will travel from various parts of the country to come and see you, and then they'll travel at several points at the same tour. Whereas here, it's like Josie was saying, because it's a new audience pretty much each night, you know, you can kind of try things out and you can sort of keep things interesting and see what works and see how things go down. So
can we hear a song?
Sure.
What are you going to play first?
This is Something Familiar.
Okay. Live on Snacky Tunes.
It was something familiar, like the sound of the sea. I forgot I remembered, like some lost part of me. It was only a flicker. It was only there for a second, and then gone from your face. Like the way we're tied, still tethered to the shore. The thought just pulled me back to before. But I know we're alone, and my mind clings to memory like a heart to a home.
reflections at sundown can make me so sad, for there's no way of keeping the day we've just had.
One of the things that's noticeable about your live show is kind of like the bounds of humor and the kind of death and doom of the lyrics. How do you kind of strike a light tone while still touching on such heavy topics?
I guess I originally started... I mean, I'm quite sarcastic anyway. Like, that's just my personality. But I started cracking jokes because I was nervous, and it made me feel more relaxed because the music's really intense, and so people feel like they have to be really quiet. And that's quite an intimidating situation. So I started making jokes just to put myself at ease, and it seemed to go down pretty well. And then you've kind of got the balance of like a 3.5 minute song where people really have to be quiet and it's really intense and they have to listen, and then you kind of give them a bit of a break,
right,
between each one.
You kind of like give the first sigh.
Yeah, like everyone can cough and breathe and laugh and just have a minute. Yeah.
Like, what's a classic icebreaker for you?
Well, I mostly talk about how miserable all of the songs are. Like, that's a really, that's an easy win.
Yeah. Like, that was depressing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that kind of puts the audience at ease, and they kind of know that you're in on the,
Yeah, and like, I've got one thing about, I tell people about how a lot of the gigs, somebody always comes up to me and says, it's really nice, but would you mind, like, why don't you just put in like a cheerful one just to like change the mood a bit? And I talk about how I'm not going to do that, that like melancholy is our specialism, and this is like five-star misery. This is how it's done. This is our thing.
Five-star misery is, that's wonderful. That's a good description of what you're in for. It's not four-star.
No, yeah,
there's going to be mint on
the
pillow.
Whack.
It's the full thing. Turn down service, everything. Yeah. One of the things that's great about the folk tradition is covers, and I know that you work in a lot of covers. Given your kind of diverse backgrounds and record collections, how do you go about picking which covers go into the sets?
I think it really depends on, for me personally, choosing things. It's the lyric content that resonates with me. So on the album, we have a cover of Gillian Welsh's Dark Turn of Mind. And I'm kind of like annoyed that I didn't write that song myself. I feel like it's about me, and I feel like I would have written it if she hadn't got there first. So that's like an obvious one. But I would imagine like Ben's criteria would be different.
I mean, it has to be something we can both like and agree to. I mean, there's no point sort of turning up and saying, okay, so we're going to do
AC/DC
or something.
Too like cheerful.
That. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh, yeah. What does it, does it have to rate high on the five-star misery?
It has to be sad. There's like, we don't even have to talk about that though. Like, that's not, no one's brought a happy song to the table, have they? No.
I mean, it's the sort of thing that we used to do a version of Jackson C. Frank's Milk and Honey. And then we ended up, Josie sort of was saying, oh, we can...
I was listening to the saxophonist Stan Getz CD. Mm-hmm. CD's quite a lot. And on one of the albums, there's Tis Autumn. Mm-hmm. And I kind of realised that... I don't know how I realized it. Like, I couldn't tell you, like, in musical theory how it works. But I kind of heard, like, melody crossover between them. And I said to Ben, like, how do you think about, like, mixing these two together? This jazz standard, Tis Autumn. It's, like, narratively appropriate. Mm-hmm. Milk and Honey, Jackson C. Frank. And he kind of looked at it, like, chordally, and he was like, yeah, we can do this. And so it happened kind of just... quite organically. Like, I had the idea one day and then we kind of made it happen.
And are there any covers that you've tried that have just not worked, no matter how much you loved it or wanted to try to get it into the set?
There's a very rare instance. We did an ABBA tribute night.
Oh, Oh, that totally
as
worked.
Abba, as Abba's playing in the background.
Yeah, that
perfectly timed. Well done.
That
well
totally done. Worked, but it was just a bit. It was a bit too happy. I mean, the song itself is not happy, but it's so musically happy, it makes everyone happy, and we were like, "Whoa,
yeah,
we can't do this."
I mean,
this
it was done as a joke rather than anything yeah. else.
Like no toe tapping at the show.
It was a gift for a friend.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it was knowing me, knowing you.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Can we hear another song?
Sure.
What's the name of this one?
It's definitely not ABBA. It's called The Light of His Lamp.
So your new record, which came out on Friday, Overnight, is your first U.S. release. The last record you did was self-produced, self-recorded, mm-hmm. self-promoted, self-everything. How is the difference with being on Rough Trade kind of influenced the process of making the most recent record versus the last one, which was all just the two of you?
I guess the biggest thing is the things it made possible. So the last album that we had done, Nothing Can Bring Back the Hour, we had done entirely in Ben's dining room because he records. And we'd recorded a small chamber orchestra from that dining room, one person at a time, and then he had kind of layered them all up and worked it all out. He'd done very clever things with microphone placement.
So as soon as we had the opportunity to sort of go and spend a week in a residential studio with enough space to do it all in one go.
Yeah, so we had like a percussionist and a pianist and a double bass player, and we could all be effectively in the same room playing a song, and that's a very different type of record to one that's been where everybody's played separately.
Did it allow for more improvisation?
Yeah,
and that's something, again, like I said, that we've wanted to work on. We specifically chose a jazz pianist, Kit Downs, because he won't play what's written on a piece of paper. He like, you can give him a rough guide, but he's gonna do his own thing, and that kind of forced us to be less like control freaky with the whole thing.
Was it? I mean, you talked about being kind of more in the flow. Mm-hmm. Before, like, is that something you were open to? Was it there a little bit of like a resistance, or?
I mean, it was something that we had consciously decided to do, but obviously we were kind of being challenged, because over the years doing records ourselves, we'd become very used to controlling absolutely everything, and I think it was a really good process for us to go through to not be able to control every element of it. But it had its. It was uncomfortable at points.
Yeah,
it,
I mean,
challenged
it was this, it was a sort of thing where, for all the previous records, we sort of put together demos and put in fake strings and all that kind of thing, and literally we knew what the final record was going to sound like, or an approximation of, when we started actually bringing in other people to play. So the scores were written out and all that kind of thing. So going to a studio and just saying, well, here's the general idea, let's jam around this and then let's bring this, sort of bring it together, was really liberating.
Yeah, so we would play the songs three or four times and then choose a take. And that's, I mean, the last album took us months and months and months, yeah. And we got it all done in 7 days, and that felt amazing.
And so now that it's the two of you on the road, how are you reinterpreting kind of your songs from the studio version to the live version?
I mean, they started off largely as just for one voice and guitar, and then we kind of had ideas about what could go on top of that, so I guess it's just taking all of that off again.
Yeah, I mean, there's bits that, because I mean, it's things like I'll have done something for the strings as an example, where we can't do that. That would then get played in the studio, but then of course you can't always have string players with you on stage or anything like that, or piano and kind of thing, so you start bringing those elements, trying to bring them back to what the guitar was doing in the first place, so you sort of reinvent.
So there are points where I noticed that a motif that the pianist has played now ends up in Ben's guitar part, which is kind of nice, because we've like gained something from that. It's given us little ideas and stuff.
And as far as like the themes and kind of evolution from this record, I mean, if you had months and months in the last one, obviously the lyrics can kind of adapt and change. 7 days or 7 days. Do you feel that the ideas had, you know, we still be able to explore, or new themes, or, you know, what are in these songs that is different than the last record?
I think for this album, like I had a lot of the songs beforehand, but this album has a much stronger holistic kind of concept than I've ever had before. Like, I've always liked to have a general sense of how the songs tie together, that they have certain themes, and I choose them on that basis. But this one was really, like, a bit more specific, and it kind of made specifications for where things could go as well, because it's from, like, afternoon all the way into, like, night and then back out into the morning again. So it kind of really defined, like, which songs could go where, which was challenging in one way, but also kind of liberating in others.
Well, I want to make sure we have time for one more song. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming and seeing me. The record is out. It's on Rough Trade. Any plans for the fall or early, I guess, early 2017? I guess we can start talking about that.
Early 2017, definitely.
Yeah, I think we're going to be back in the US at
some
point.
Oh, amazing. What city? Do you know what cities you're hitting?
At this point, no.
Head shake from the manager out there as well, no.
I could see him, like, moving about, but yeah. I didn't know what he was trying to tell me.
No, too much detail.
No.
Okay, well, where can people, if they want to get in contact here, get the record, etc., where can they find you, Instagram, social media, etc.?
We're on all of them, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, We have a website. We've now got Spotify profiles if you want to hear playlists for what we're listening to. Obviously, there's the Rough Trade website. You can definitely get the album from there.
So. Okay. Well, thanks for tuning into this episode. We're going to hear one more song, and we will be back next week with a whole new show. What are you going to play for us?
We're going to play the title track.
Okay.
Overnight.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El-Waeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.